Okay, today we'll get started. We want to approve the minutes or bring it to order yet until we get one more person in here. But we'll start out with the Minnesota Judicial Branch Overview. And Mr. Shorba, state your name and title and begin, sir. And then don't feel bad if I interrupt you when somebody walks in, and we'll bring it to order.
No problem. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. Happy to be here with you this morning to present an overview of Minnesota's third branch of government. The Judicial Branch's mission is clear, to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. We take each word in this mission statement very seriously, especially ensuring our system is fair and our cases are resolved in a timely manner. And we'll discuss this more as we go through the presentation.
Okay, Mr. Shorba, we can bring the meeting to order now, and to have a quorum, we'll start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Russell. Representative Howell. Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay, motion to approve the minutes from January 12th. Anybody? Representative Lucero, would you like to move the minutes of January 12th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Lucero moves the minutes of January 12th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Mr. Shorba, sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
No problem. The work of the Minnesota courts is a core government function addressed in the first article of the Minnesota Constitution. Our Constitution guarantees that all Minnesotans are entitled to obtain justice without purchase, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay. Every Minnesotan is entitled to a remedy in both criminal and civil cases via the Minnesota Constitution. The judicial branch has 317 judges and approximately 2,500 employees. The branch handles about 1.3 million cases in 106 locations with a biennial general fund budget of $638 million. Interestingly, the Minnesota Judicial Branch operates in more geographic locations than any other part of state government. The branch is fully state-funded, and this budget funds the judges, staff, and operations for all trial courts, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, the State Law Library, and the State Court Administrator's Office. Minnesota has a streamlined three-tier structure of two appellate courts and a single trial court called the District Court. The Court of Appeals was created via constitutional amendment in 1983 to help deal with the large number of appeals from the trial courts. The Supreme Court has seven members who hear and decide cases as a group. The Court of Appeals has 19 members who hear cases in three-judge panels, and the trial court has 291 judges, and I'll talk about each of these courts in a little bit more detail. The seven-member Supreme Court hears appeals, which we call petitions for further review, from the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. In addition, the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, which means these cases go directly to the Supreme Court for first-degree murder convictions, legislative election contests, and for judicial and attorney discipline. In 2015, 615 petitions for further review were filed with the court, and 143 direct appeals were filed. The Supreme Court also has sole authority for the regulation of the practice of law in Minnesota. We exercise this authority through a number of boards. There is no state appropriation for these boards. They are funded through attorney registration fees. The Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board oversees and administers the attorney discipline system. The Client Security Fund was established by the Supreme Court to reimburse clients who suffer loss of money or other property from the dishonest conduct of their attorneys. The Board of Law Examiners administers the process to license attorneys to practice law in Minnesota, conducting background checks, administering the bar examination. The Board of Continuing Legal Education oversees the administration of the rules for continuing legal education for attorneys. And then finally, the Board of Legal Certification accredits organizations that certify lawyers as specialists in certain fields of law. Court of Appeals hears appeals from trial court decisions, administrative agency decisions, and the Commissioner of Department of Employment and Economic Development, or unemployment claims. Court of Appeals has original jurisdiction to hear writs of mandamus or prohibition, which is situations where you're compelling a trial court, corporation, or public authority to either do something or refrain from doing something. In 2015, there were 1,953 appeals filed with the Court of Appeals. And finally, the largest court, the trial courts. There are 291 judges in the trial courts. They hear original actions in a variety of case types outlined on this slide. They also have a conciliation court division that hears small civil disputes up to $15,000. I'll talk a little bit more about the trial court since it is the largest and has the most filings. This slide shows the trial court filings broken down by what we classify as major and minor case types. Major case types would include gross misdemeanors, felonies, contract cases, personal injury, malpractice, employment, harassment, larger cases. The minor cases would be conciliation court, unlawful detainers, implied consent, misdemeanor, DWI. In terms of workload, it is important to note that judges spend 82% of their time on the major case types. So I want to give a little bit more information on those. This slide shows, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Zorba, just a curiosity point, out of all of the cases that are referred to the appellate court from the district court for appeal, how many of them are reversed? Any idea?
Not off the top of my head, but I can get that information for the committee if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
This slide shows the breakdown of the major case types. As you can see, criminal cases are the largest percentage of cases filed, followed by family cases and civil cases in the district courts. A little bit about where we're seeing some changes in the workload of the trial courts. Since fiscal year 12, the judicial branch has seen an increase in the number of major case filings and an increase in the complexity of the cases brought to the trial courts. As a result, 8 of our 10 judicial districts have seen an upward trend in judge need. The most marked increase is in children in need of protection services, or CHIPS cases, and permanency cases, with a 56% increase in filings from fiscal year 12 to fiscal year 16. Over the last year, major criminal cases, felonies and gross misdemeanors, have arisen 12%. And then drug-related case filings, which are a subcategory of the major criminal group, increased 25% over the last year. So we are seeing increases in some of these larger, more complex case types across the state. Our trial courts operate in all counties, but we are organized in 10 judicial districts for administrative purposes and also election purposes, as I'll discuss in a minute. We have two single county judicial districts, the second and the fourth, which are Ramsey and Hennepin. The other 8 are multi-county districts, ranging from 4 counties in the 6th district in northeastern Minnesota to our largest district, which is the 9th, with 17 counties in the northwestern part of the state. These districts are important for election purposes for some of our trial court judges. For trial court judges, Supreme Court and Court of Appeal judges are elected statewide to 6-year terms. District court judges are elected by their judicial district to 6-year terms. And if there are midterm vacancies, they are filled by the governor. By statute, there is a judicial selection commission that the governor is required to use to fill trial court vacancies. He or she is not required to use it for appellate vacancies, but often they will use the same commission to fill those vacancies. Complaints against judges are filed with the Board on Judicial Standards, which is composed of 10 members appointed by the governor. The board can issue reprimands, either public or private, to judges, and can also refer discipline actions to the Supreme Court to take. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shore, we have a question. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zorba, I'm not an attorney. So looking back at slide 10, when you started listing the some examples of major and minor cases, mm-hmm. and then went on to explain major cases a little bit more, I wondered if you could give me a definition. What distinguishes a major and a minor?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, in our classification system, it's the amount of time it takes to resolve the cases. So we've tried to break them down in terms of the ones that take more time to resolve, more hearings to resolve, and those that are resolved more quickly. So that's the breakdown. And then we break them down by the types I explained.
Okay.
The Ward?
Just clarification. Who makes that decision then? Because you don't necessarily know in advance.
Mr. Shorba.
Do you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward. We have a system within the judicial branch for trying to, and I'll come back when we have our budget hearing to talk about judge need within the judicial branch. So we have what we call a weighted caseload study, which looks at the amount of time it takes judges to handle cases, and then we look at the number of filings of those particular types of cases as they come into the court system, which helps to generate our decision about whether we need more judges for the judicial branch. So these are set by the Judicial Council as part of that weighted caseload study, and I'll be coming back in the budget session to talk a little bit more about where our judge need is right now, if that helps.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shorman.
A little bit about the administrative structure of the judicial branch. As many of you know, in 2005, the judicial branch moved from county funding of the state court system to state funding of the court system through the general fund. At that time, we also changed our administrative structure to implement a judicial council. The Chief Justice is the administrative head of the judicial branch by statute and serves as the chair of the judicial council. The State Court Administrator's Office, my staff serve as staff to the judicial council. And then the Chief Justice, of course, leads the Supreme Court. And there's a chief judge of the Court of Appeals appointed by the governor for a three-year term, who serves at the head of that court. And then each of our district courts has a chief judge who is elected by their peers for a two-year term. And then we have county court administrators. At the time we moved to state funding, there were 87 county court administrators. At this time we have 50 because we have moved to sharing among some of our smaller counties, sharing court administrators. The Judicial Council is really the single statewide policymaking body for our judicial branch. It has 25 members, 19 judges, and 6 administrators. And as I mentioned, the Chief Justice serves as the chair of the council. Some of their primary responsibilities, administrative policies for the judicial branch, developing our biennial strategic plan for the judiciary, setting our legislative agenda, including our budget request to the legislature, is set by the Judicial Council. And then the Council also spends a lot of time looking at performance and accountability issues.
Mr. Chair. Shorten, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 6 county administrators are not voting members, though?
Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, they are not voting members. They are non-voting members.
Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Shorba.
Some of our timeliness goals and accountability goals here you see on the slide. Are we open and affordable and understandable by the public? Our cases, are they handled in a timely manner? Do we maintain an accurate and complete and timely record for those who are interacting with the court system? Are we making fair decisions? Do we provide due process and equal protection under the law? And, of course, are we a quality place to work? Some of these measures by the Judicial Council to look into these, we do access and fairness surveys of those coming into our courts to see whether they believe that things are accessible, whether things are understandable. Can we gain any insight from those, whether they're lawyers or non-lawyers who are coming into our court system? We also have a regular process for surveying our judges and our court staff about the workplace and how they are doing within the workplace, and again, if they have any ways that we can improve. We look at timing statistics on a regular basis through the council. How long does it take for us to dispose cases? How many cases are still pending? What is the length of time for certain actions like adoption and permanency for children in need of protection? We also publish an annual report. A report for 2016 will be coming out in February, and we'll send all of you on our committee a link to that report that we publish annually. A couple of initiatives I wanted to cover with the committee. The first is eCourt Minnesota. This has really been a centerpiece of our redesign initiatives within the Minnesota court system. This multi-year transformational effort is meant to replace paper-based court records with an electronic environment. We undertook this initiative in order to provide the type of convenient, customer-serviced focus that our customers are expecting in this day and age. It began in 2010 when Hennepin County, the 4th Judicial District, began to pilot the electronic filing of case records in civil cases. And then on July 1st of 2016, e-filing became mandatory for all case types in the courts. We believe that court customers have benefited from this. They are now able to access securely file and court records on a 24/7 basis. They don't have to be coming to the courthouse during those business hours anymore. We now have expanded access to court records, including the ability to access public documents via public terminals in all 87 counties. So you can go to a terminal in Hennepin and see documents from all over the state. Judges and court staff now have new electronic tools to help manage and process electronic court documents. And law enforcement, county attorneys, public defenders, and other government partners have an electronic portal to instantly access information. Just a few statistics from both Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stover, we have a question. We have a question from Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question was about, I heard you refer to people who access the courts as customers. Mm-hmm. And in my other life, I work with domestic violence victims. And I'm wondering if that was what's behind the choice of that language.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know if there's any big philosophical choice behind the language, but there are people coming in that we want to serve. So customer service is a big priority for us, and I guess that's why we're using, sometimes people call them patrons, sometimes people call them
okay, I was
partners.
Just curious if there was any thought given that to that, because I know for domestic violence victims, they don't like to think of themselves as customers. You know, it's not a Starbucks. It's they're coming for a service that they need. And so I was just curious if there's anything behind the choice or if that, just if any thought had gone into that choice of language. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no thought, and I'm glad you raised that issue. I've never heard that issue before, but it's a good point to raise. It's really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
We also have another question from Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of my experience was with Dakota County, but I remember several years ago with the access at the courthouses for a lot of these pieces of information and the documentation, we found out that there was opportunity for people in their various searches to actually access juvenile files. And, you know, there was some attempt to address that, but I think the same thing would apply in terms of domestic violence and a couple of other situations where the victim would not like to be identified. What's the security? What's the process for maintaining privacy on some of those things?
Mr. Sherwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I'd be happy to come and talk to you in more detail about it, but as we were moving to the electronic age about a year and a half ago, the Supreme Court's Committee on the Rules of Public Access looked into many of those issues that you're talking about, especially as we're moving, as you'll see in a future slide, to remote access. There's a lot of discussion about the issues you've raised about juveniles and others. Should those records be public? Should they not be public? And the court changed many of the rules to try to address those concerns. So I'd be happy to come and talk more detail about some of those case types. But
thank you.
Any follow-up? Mr. Schwaber, go ahead and continue on with your presentation.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the statistics. We're averaging more than 260,000 documents e-filed each month into our case management system. 45,000 also into the appellate case system. Combined, this equates to more than 1.75 million documents e-filed just during the first 6 months of mandatory e-filing. So you think just a few short years ago, those were all paper being put into file folders, and that has now changed, including our integrations. As you see from the slide, our case management system, the Minnesota Court Information System, now sends daily about 268,000 messages to our partners every day. So used to be that someone would walk down to the probation department and tell them what happened in court that day. All of that is now sent electronically through the case management system. In conjunction with the implementation of eCourt, we have worked with the law enforcement agencies and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to implement two initiatives aimed at providing greater efficiencies in the processing of criminal cases. As of July 1, 2016, both of these became mandatory. E-charging, county attorneys must file complaints electronically with the court, including getting the judge's review and signature on the prosecutor's criminal complaint electronically. And then e-citations, local law enforcement electronically submitting traffic citations to the courts, which saves time and effort in processing those tickets. Some of our next steps, as I mentioned briefly, we're looking at remote access to public documents, allowing attorneys and members of the public to access public documents in a case from anywhere, not just the courthouse terminal. E-notify is a process we're looking to automatically notify parties when a document has been added to their case. We're also looking at some electronic reminders for those who may have an appointment in court to remind them of those appointments. And then we're looking at ways we might be able to re-engineer our work. Now that the work is electronic, we're no longer tied down by the location of the work and can process work in a different way across the state because we're not tied down by those public paper records. Other initiatives besides eCourt that I just want to mention. First, self-represented litigant services. One of the biggest challenges in the court system is the increasing number of self-represented litigants. As the number of people choosing to represent themselves in court proceedings continues to grow, Minnesota has become a nationally recognized leader in providing services to self-represented litigants. Some examples, our statewide self-help center provides assistance through online help topics, our public website, and one-on-one services provided for free, both over the phone and through email. In 2015, the Self-Help Center provided one-on-one support to over 25,000 Minnesotans via email and phone, and thousands more who visited our website. At more than 100 locations, courthouse locations across the state, we've installed self-help workstations consisting of a desk, computer, printer, and a phone that can be used to find court information, print court forms, and talk over the phone with staff in our self-help center. In addition, several of our district courts have created walk-in centers where someone can come in and get help on a regular basis with cases that they need help with. In 2016, the State Law Library created a appellate self-help clinic. Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto and then Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Shriba, I have the impression, I'm sure we'll get into this much more later in the session in much more detail, but I have the impression that this self-help, these services are enormously cost-effective. And can you just talk a little bit about that? I may have that wrong impression, but it just seems like when you can have somebody helping themselves, potentially you save just a ton of work in other areas. Can you just comment a little bit about that in relation to this topic?
Mr. Shriba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. When a self-represented litigant comes into court without assistance, it takes a lot of time for the judge to try to help that person get through the proceeding in court. And as we see the number of self-represented people increasing and increasing in various case types, especially some of those major cases where it's very complicated, it is much more helpful to the court proceeding if they can have some assistance early on, can get their documentation together, can have the right kinds of documents coming into court. So we have seen it help us speed up those particular cases involving self-represented litigants. Thank you for that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sorbin, my question goes to, I've got a constituent that has been pretty persistent on saying that some of these self-help clinics or the law libraries that are in different locations, aren't, there's not a lot of signage that directs people to these, and he even chose to show, send me pictures and everything else. Is do we have a standard on, or is it, have we done anything to make sure that the public knows that how to get to these libraries and where they're at, and maybe listing them on the sign out in front of the building? Is there anything like that?
Mr. Schroeder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I'm very familiar with the person you're talking about, and we have been working with the county law libraries. The counties own the buildings where these courts are and where the law libraries are, so they're well aware of some of the signage questions that have been raised. If you've gone by the Judicial Center, we have a new sign outside the Judicial Center, which has the state law library prominently displayed on it. We've also put up a sign in the lobby itself directing people to the state law library. So we have tried to accommodate some of those concerns that are raised. So.
Representative Holland.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. That's probably why the state law library is not on his list any longer, but and it just so happens that he happens to be in one of my constituents, and I can't believe the packet of information he sends me and the pictures all the time. So I appreciate that you've done your due diligence in correcting that. Thank you.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, Representative Howe, I have one of those in my inbox right now, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Finally, we have an extensive forms library. If you're ever looking for court forms, you can go to our website and you'll see that a number of our forms are there electronically, many of them fillable by individuals who are coming into our court system. We've received a number of awards for our self-help center, so we're very proud of it. Another thing we've...
Mr. Chair.
Representative...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what are you doing to deal with the issue of multiple languages through the self-help center? And do you have access for folks who speak different languages to call in or get some sort of interpretation?
Mr. Schroeder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. We're doing a number of things with those concerns. One is trying to translate as many of our forms as possible into multiple languages. Sometimes that takes a little time, but especially the ones that are most popular, we have tried to translate into multiple languages. We do try as much as we can to hire staff in the self-help center who are multilingual. Obviously, if they are not multilingual, we do have interpreter services, just like we'd use in court, sometimes a language line, which might be a telephone line. Otherwise, we may have try to schedule a time with an individual and have one of our staff interpreters there to help somebody who doesn't speak English through the self-help center. So those are some of the things we're trying to do to deal with that issue.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Schroeder, go ahead.
On to our conservator account auditing program, or CAP. It's a nation-leading initiative to protect the assets of vulnerable individuals, persons with development disabilities, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, for whom the court has appointed a conservator to manage the individual's financial affairs. Through CAP, the Minnesota Judicial Branch has modernized and improved the way the state oversees the work of conservators. Before implementation of this program, conservator records were submitted to the court on paper, frequently accompanied by boxes of receipts or other documentation. This unwieldy process put a heavy burden on local district court staff responsible for overseeing the work of conservators. So we changed the process in two fundamental ways. One is conservators now submit transactions through an initiative, intuitive online reporting system, which also contains some built-in red flags to try to see whether there's anything that may be seemingly out of order with the paperwork that the conservator is submitting. We also have a staff of auditors who audit these accounts and are trained to conduct compliance audits across the state. Today, the program is monitoring the assets of 5,575 vulnerable individuals with assets totaling more than $908 million. The stronger auditing program has already paid off. In nearly 12% of the cases audited under the program, auditors have found concerns of loss, inappropriate loans or expenditures, or commingling of funds. And we then send out audit letters and make sure that we are recovering those funds. So it is a program that has gotten national attention and national awards. We also received a grant to now expand the program to monitor guardianship as well as conservatorship cases. So that is the next step with this particular program.
Mr. Schorber, how big was that grant and how long does it last? And if it drops, what are we going to do?
The grant is to develop the electronic system for guardianship cases, so it'll tailor it to guardianship cases. So it's a one-time grant to develop the computer system that will help work just like the conservator one did. So it's just one time. I can't remember the amount of money. I believe it's $250,000, but I'll get back to you on the exact amount.
I mean, you folks are pretty careful that when you do get grants, you don't, obligate yourself heavily so that if they fall, that we end up paying the bill.
Mr. Chair, we're very conservative with the tails that come with grants with respect to the ones we submit, except for ones we'll talk about in a minute when we talk about treatment courts and drug courts. So,
thank you.
I want to mention our court payment center. In 2016, we completed the transition of the 4th District to the court payment center. This means that all of our payable citations or tickets are processed centrally rather than having that work spread across 87 counties. We offer online and over the phone payment options, which has made it easier for individuals interacting with the courts to complete their work. We're also creating some efficiencies within the judicial branch. Our payment center processed almost 1 million citations a year, and we're also responsible for managing the funds that come in from those citations as well. Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schorber, I have a question. Is the court payment center... back when I was a deputy, it happened numerous times. Our county had gone to that system. And what was happening, people were paying their fines, but the information was not getting back to the courts. So the courts would send the paperwork, and the people were getting their driver's license suspended. They'd have to pay the reinstatement fees, but they also had paid their fines. Has things been done to get that issue worked out to make sure the information is getting passed back to the courts properly in a timely fashion so people are not getting their license suspended and having to incur more costs to get their license back, go on high risk because they got stopped for driving after suspension, and lose their driver's license again?
Mr. Schorber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, as part of the transition to this court payment center, and one way that we moved away from all 87 counties doing things differently, we tried to integrate a lot of those things electronically to come back to the court system so that it didn't have to rely on some court clerk doing something or someone handling paper. So I believe we've resolved that issue. If you hear of concerns still going on, I'd like to know about them.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Schorber.
The last area I want to cover.
Oops. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go back one slide to the court payment center. One of the things that we have also heard is that if people are ordered to pay restitution under any of the criminal cases, that the person has to be on probation because supervised probation, because otherwise there's no way to monitor whether or not they've actually paid. Are you studying or looking at changing the way restitution is dealt with through the court payment center in order to alleviate some of those issues?
Mr. Schorber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I have not heard of that issue. I'd be happy to hear a little bit more about it. I do not believe we're doing anything right now to change that, but if there are some concerns, I'll come and talk to you about those.
All right,
thank you.
Okay, Mr. Schorber.
Last area I want to talk about is treatment courts. Treatment courts represent a shift in the way courts are handling certain offenders and working with key stakeholders in the justice system. It's really a collaboration between courts, prosecutors, public defenders, probation officers, social workers, and other justice system partners to develop a strategy to talk with an offender, work with an offender into completing a treatment program and abstaining from repeating the behaviors that brought them to court in the first place. Strategies include extended probation, frequent appearances before a judge, frequent meetings with probation officers, and other methods to try to change the behavior of individuals. When we talk about treatment courts, it's a broad umbrella. And as you can see from this slide, there are a number of different treatment courts that we have here in Minnesota, traditionally called drug courts, chemical dependency issues, DWI courts for those who have alcohol addiction issues and have been caught driving under the influence, hybrid courts where you may have multiple issues. Maybe you have drug issues, but you also have DWI issues. Mental health courts, where we're trying to address the underlying mental health needs of an individual who is frequently coming into court. Family dependency courts, where we are addressing parental issues, where children may be in need of protection, but the underlying issue is parents who have substance abuse concerns. And then veterans courts, where we're trying to address the needs of veterans who have been charged with certain crimes. This next slide gives you an idea of how these courts are spread out across Minnesota. We have 58 treatment courts operating in Minnesota or in some stage of planning right now. 11 of those are multi-county programs. So one judge is serving, working with prosecutors and public defenders and others from multiple counties across the state. These courts have been extensively evaluated both on the national level and also here in Minnesota. Research shows that this approach, although it may take more time, has proven very effective in dealing with these type of offenders. Since 2012, Minnesota has conducted 3 statewide evaluations of treatment courts. In 2012, the branch released a statewide evaluation that compared drug court participants to similar offenders and found that drug court participants were less likely to reoffend, spent less time incarcerated, reducing costs to taxpayers, and showed gains in employment, educational achievement, home rental ownership, and payment of child support. In 2014, we performed a follow-up analysis with similar results, and then our DWI courts were also evaluated with similar results. As was asked by the chair, here's a summary of how these courts are funded. The judicial branch receives an appropriation from the legislature, $5.6 million for the biennium, which provides funding towards 27 of our 58 problem-solving courts. The remaining cost is funded by grants from a variety of entities, the Office of Traffic Safety, the Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, the Office of Justice Programs, Department of Human Services, and the Department of Veterans Affairs for a total biennial budget of approximately $15 million. Over the past 2 years, the branch has been working to develop a funding formula to try to better sustain these courts. As grants go away, we need to find ways to sustain the courts, either through additional funding, local funding. We'll be talking a little bit more about that sustainability formula as we come to you with our budget request for the next biennium. In conclusion, I want to briefly outline our present and future activities and focus. We have been committed to continue to provide court services in a manner that is focused on convenience and access, ensuring public trust and confidence in our judicial branch through efficient and effective court operations, putting in some changes to hopefully do our work better as we move out of this e-court environment and have fully implemented it now as of last July. How can we do our work in a more efficient and effective way to build a stronger justice system? Mr. Chair, I'm available for questions from committee members.
Okay, we've got 2 members so far, Representative Pinto and Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shrub, I'd love to get some concrete numbers on the savings for treatment courts. So it's $7.5 million that we're spending in terms of the cost each year. Do you have any sense as to, based on maybe the evaluations that were performed, as to what the savings are, both the amounts and kind of the time frame of those savings?
Mr. Shrub.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, we have some anecdotal evidence. We could tell you, for example, how many beds we think we're saving. There has not been a formal cost comparison study done to ask how much do the drug courts cost versus how much do they save, for example, corrections or jails or others so it's not formal, but we can certainly get you the information that we garnered from reduced recidivism and other kinds of things in terms of savings.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Finnell.
Thank you. That would be great. And if there's a way to convert those numbers into dollars, it seems like that would be maybe perhaps not with a real formal and understood that if you're really going to get into it, you've got to have a real detailed analysis. But it seems like it would be useful. We know we're spending $7.5 million going out. And so the question is to be able to convert that into actual dollars. So I guess that would be a request that I'd make is in addition to that information about beds, et cetera, whatever could be converted into dollars seems like it would be helpful as we're evaluating that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sharba, looking at the treatment courts here, it seems that the high amount of drug and DWI courts, 36, juvenile drug courts, 1. Has there any been thought given or is there a need to possibly increase the amount of juvenile drug courts versus the large amount of the drug and DWI courts, whether it be a need or a thought process to kind of nip that in the bud before we get to the larger issue as juveniles turn to adults?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Frankie, the reason why we only have one juvenile drug court is some of the studies have suggested that as compared with the adult drug courts, the juvenile drug courts aren't quite as effective as the adult drug courts are, whether that's because of maturity levels of kids or the type of ways you might get them to change their behavior. They haven't proven quite as effective. Therefore, as some of these are funded through grants and other kinds of things, the federal government and others haven't been offering as many grants in the juvenile area because of the national studies that have shown they might not be as effective. That's why we only have one there. And I can certainly show you some of those studies and talk a little bit more with you about that as we come and see you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharba.
Mm-hmm. Question. Mr. Sharba, have you figured out a way that if you have a drastic cut in like a federal grant or something, stop short of a way where it impacts things other than FTEs, like a cushion you made up ahead of time where if this happens, a possible scenario, or would you have to consider everything?
Mr. Chair, you're talking about treatment courts here?
Yes, sorry.
Obviously, we are concerned about cuts. Part of the thing that we'll be talking about when we come with our funding request is our new funding formula to implement, which will cost some money to better stabilize these courts. One of the things that happens when you are having sort of ad hoc federal funding is the federal government may decide to give one drug court a large amount of money when we might not have funded it that way because of the number of participants. So two things that the funding formula will help us do. One is to make sure that there is a minimum number of participants in order to operate a drug court and get state money so that you're not operating a drug court with 5 people in it, that you'd have a minimum of at least 25 individuals, which will promote more multi-court funding. And then the second, that there be some kind of a local match. We have benefits, as Representative Pinto has alluded to, coming not only to the State Department of Corrections, but also to local county jails where they're not having to have as many people go to jail. They maybe are having better luck with people paying child support. They may be keeping families together. So both of those things are part of the new formula. That's the way that we're hoping that we can try to ease some of the threat of courts closing when grants go away.
Are you talking about a state-mandated share by counties? In other words, if you tried to drag money out of them on their goodwill and that's short, so you need something to mandate it, or what are you thinking about as far as their partial cost?
Mr. Chair, we're talking about not only cash, obviously, but also maybe in-kind services, so maybe probation services or other kinds of services that they could allocate towards the drug court. So maybe a dedicated probation officer or something else rather than just cash. But we think that in order to spread evenly this amount of state money, we're going to need to have some federal buy-in to this process. So we're looking at various percentages that we might use.
Keeping in mind that probation did come to us and say that their funding had been cut, a certain share of it, by the judiciary back a while ago. I can't remember if I remember bringing that up to you folks or something, that they were still expected to do the same service or not mandated, but expected to with cuts. So, yeah, we'll have to figure that one out. Representative Hillstrom and the Representative Howell.
Mr. Chair, can you explain to me when a court, specialty court, got a grant from the state and then they received federal money, the state then required them to return some of the state money. Can you explain to me that process? When is that required? When is it not required? Is it always required?
Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, in order to operate as a treatment court within Minnesota, a court must get approval from the Judicial Council. So a court will go to the Judicial Council, will talk about where their funding might come from. Maybe they are asking for funding from the state, but they also might tell us at the time they want to open the drug court that they're applying for a federal grant. So what the Judicial Council in those circumstances will say to the court, we're willing to provide you this kind of state money to open, but if you are given a federal grant, then that state money will be used in some other way. You're not going to be able to keep that state money because the federal grant will give you enough money to operate. So that's the situation where that could come up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many times has that occurred?
I would say maybe, just guessing here, I can get you real numbers, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I would say less than half a dozen.
Okay, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schroeder, I see in the treatment court funding, I'm looking at this list, and I see some comes from DPS, some comes from the Department of Human Services, Department, other state agencies. So the question I have is, wouldn't it be more efficient? Are these grants that are awarded to these state agencies and then goes through to you, or is this funding that we should just, instead of playing the shell game, give to you instead of these other state agencies?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, it's a variety. Some of it is federal money that these state agencies get. So, for example, the Office of Traffic Safety gives some federal grant monies to the Department of Public Safety, which they then turn to us for DWI courts. The Department of Human Services gets some money from the federal mental health organization, and they give those to us for mental health courts. Some of it is state-appropriated dollars, but a small amount that they may give out. So there might be some way to make it more efficient by putting it together, but that would be your job. We've had those discussions with other agencies, but yes.
Yeah, I would enjoy that discussion. Thank you.
Okay, any more questions from members? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Sharma.
Thank you.
The courts. Anybody else have anything? If not, meeting adjourned.